I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we're going to be speaking with Magali Lakoli. She was formerly the executive director of Northwest Arkansas Workers Justice Center, but she is now the co-founder and director of Venceremos, a worker-based organization in Arkansas whose mission is to ensure the human rights of poultry workers. Venceremos seeks to spearhead adaptation of the worker-driven social responsibility model to the poultry supply chain, which God knows needs it, as does every other food worker organization in the country. Magali, welcome, and thank you so much for giving me more of your time. People should know that Magali is also featured in one of our most recent Big Food Question segments. So if you want to learn more, go ahead and listen to that. But we'll be covering a lot of the same territory today. So Magali, let's start with just give us a quick thumbnail of what is Venceremos? How does it work?
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me to your
show. You betcha, girl.
Yeah, so Venceremos was born in 2019 in October. It's a worker-led organization, so I co-founded Venceremos with a group of poultry women workers working in different plants in the Northwest Arkansas. And we was born with the idea after traveling to Immokalee, Florida in 2018, to the idea of adapting the worker-driven social responsibility model. So Venceremos works to ensure the human rights of poultry workers in Arkansas, but eventually we hope that we can expand this model to other states to protect more poultry workers.
Sure, absolutely. So how is your model more effective than, say, you know, bringing in a union? Because it seems to me that, like, the Immokalee tomato workers, you know, this is what you model your organization after. They were able to affect real change in their industry. What is different from the way you and they operate than a union would operate, for instance?
Yeah, well, I've been working directly with poultry workers for 7 years, and we are here. We lived in Arkansas. Arkansas is a right-to-work state, but also is a corporate state. So corporations have a lot of influence over the government. And being in a right-to-work state also makes the unions pretty weak and not really functioning as they should. So I know through my experience that workers tend to not trust the unions. And unions are not doing a lot of work of expanding more unions into processing plants. You know, I think only 20% of the industry is unionized, and in Arkansas, only one plant in Dardanelle is the only Tyson plant that is unionized. So really, there is not unions. You know, it's the unions are not as strong. So therefore, workers do not trust the unions, and it's just an ongoing issue.
Sure. Well, you know, I want to dial this back for a second. Remind us of what right to work state means. I think there's a lot of people who are not clear on what that means. And I want you to define that.
And especially because it sounds so positive, right?
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. So really, basically, the dark part of that is that the bosses can fire you for any reason or not reason at all. So the employee, the yeah, the employers can fire workers for any reason. So that
at will.
At will, yeah. So really that affects a lot of workers that get retaliated against for speaking up in their jobs. So that makes it more complicated for workers to empower themselves because really there is not a leverage for them to fight. And also it's like this union busting, you know, that it's very dominant in the South, that unions are not as strong because of that. So it makes it really hard for any union to campaign in the South.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that people understood exactly what that means, because it is, it does, as you said, it sounds so positive. You also mentioned something just now about how Arkansas is heavily controlled by these corporate entities such as Tyson, which has a lot of plants down in that area. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about the conflict that is presented by companies like Tyson, who donate heavily to local charities and yet continue to exploit workers to their advantage. So, you know, to me, that's like they are buying incredible public relations. Oh, yes. And as I said to you before we went on the air, you know, I just read this piece in Drover's Daily or something like that about how Tyson was donating $50 million in bonuses to, you know, frontline workers. Well, you know, that's great. But where's the wage increase? Where's the bathroom breaks? Where's the, you know, where are the human rights here? So talk a little bit about that, how that plays out in communities in your area of Northwest Arkansas.
Yeah, well, I think it's very important for people to understand, like, this company, like the meat industry and the poultry industry have gained a lot of political power through lobbying to controlling the government and the narratives in their own communities. And so, for instance, Tyson has been very successful in controlling the narratives in the communities where they are. Tyson is based in Arkansas. Yep. So therefore, they have a lot of influence over the government, but also another way to influence or to control or to maintain power is by charity. You know, charity can be is useful in places where there is a lot of injustice.
Yes.
But the bad side of that is that these companies use charity in a very evil way, in the ways to control the narratives and the communities. For example, when I began organizing poultry workers in 2014, well, I first was in 2013 was when I began hearing the stories of workers directly of how they were unable to work due to accidents, injuries. And to me, it was shocking that most of these workers didn't have any justice. Like workers who had accidents on those plants were left out with any jobs, with any possibility to find new jobs because of their conditions, their health conditions. But also it was shocking to me that these workers didn't have any legal leverage to fight
right.
back. And so because here it's very difficult to find lawyers or attorneys, they will go against these companies, right?
Wow.
And so, a lot of the churches where these workers go receive funding from these companies. So it's very hard for the workers to speak about their own issues. So in 2014, when I began trying to seek solutions, it was even a taboo on my with talking about the issues with poultry workers with other community leaders. You know, when I brought the issue like, oh, wait, we are fighting here for immigrants, we are fighting here for justice, human rights, but what about the accountability of these corporations, what they're
sure.
doing to create the cycles of poverty in our communities? But this suddenly, that was like a moment of silence. Nobody wanted to talk about that. And to me, it was like, well, we need to tackle this issue. We need to, in order to change systemically the problems, we need to help these companies accountable for what they're doing, because they are creating this exploitation going on in our communities that nobody wants to talk about.
Right.
And so really, when I began, when I was the director of the Worker Justice Center, for instance, it was very hard to continue the work the way that it was needed to empower workers, to uplift workers' voices, because they saw that I was too radical, you know, that suddenly to fight for justice is too radical in Arkansas.
Right.
It is too radical because we need to tackle the real issues.
Yeah.
And so I've been retaliated against too in a community, isolated, you know, I've been named militant, I've been named radical, but I've been named those names because the work that we are doing has been really effective, you know,
uh-huh,
in creating
sure.
the space for workers to speak up. And so it's been a journey of gaining first the trust of workers, because when you're organized with poultry workers that have been dehumanized for decades, that feel hopeless in the environment where they are, where there's anti-immigrant laws, where nobody can talk about against these corporations.
Right.
When I began talking to these workers about, we have to change things, the workers were like, no, Magali, nobody can against these companies. They were already stated that they were powerless, you know, about changing their own working conditions. So for me, it's been a journey to be alongside with poultry workers to create the solutions, because I needed to gain the trust that the workers trusted me to lead this fight with them. And it's been an ongoing work, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It ain't fixed yet.
Exactly. Because workers sometimes call me and say, are you with Tyson or not? And I'm like, no.
Yikes.
You know, it's just because, and I don't blame them, because
no.
they know that if they go to an organization to receive services or resources, they know that these organizations are also receiving funding from Tyson. So they know that even though they need them, they won't trust them necessarily, you know?
Sure. So that's how the charity part of this works,
yeah.
is that these organizations that are theoretically providing resources or services to poultry workers are actually tools, you know, essentially funded by Tyson, and probably act as, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to say that they're rats or, you know, deliberately harming workers, but the end result is that they cannot provide the real service needed, which is to try to address some of these fundamental injustices that you're dealing with. So one of the other things I wanted to talk about, like among many things before we get too far into this, is, and we talked about this before, but Tyson, you know, ran that ad in the New York Times and other major national newspapers saying, you know, where our food chain is breaking down, meat workers have to be recognized as an essential service, and the government, you know, has to pledge that meat workers have to stay in their jobs and so forth, so that they can keep their supply chain running. And so, you know, there were a lot of meatpacking workers, not just poultry, but all across the protein categories. A lot of those workers got sick. Many, many of them died, but tens of thousands of them got very sick. And eventually Tyson et al. Have had to put some money into PPE, personal protective equipment, et cetera. But do you feel that they have ultimately done what is necessary to increase the safety of poultry workers in their plants, or is it more or less window dressing?
Yeah, no, not necessarily they have addressed. They've been, you know, in March of 2020, when the economy shut down and everybody went home to work from home and the essential
right.
workers had to remain in their jobs, we knew that the workers were not protected. They were not given PPE
right.
adequate. They were not even allowed to practice social distancing because of the ways that the company was structured. And so we had to organize with the workers and help them, you know, to organize the workers to fight, to stand up and demand that. So it's been
sure.
a roller coaster of actions that we've been doing, and that we know that because of that, Tyson and other companies began providing the basic benefits. However, we knew that there were demands that workers were demanding back in April of 2020. That was the tracing workers and that were in contact with positive cases to notify workers who were exposed to cases to give workers quarantine, you know.
Yeah.
And none of that, those are really some of the basics to stop the spread, you know?
Sure, absolutely.
Contact tracing, to put people in quarantine, to notify people. And those things, they refused to do that because they knew if they were going to do that, they wouldn't have workers in the plant anymore. And they were going to be forced to shut down. Precisely because they didn't want to do that, they refused to notify workers. And they're still refusing that. So the companies haven't learned, you know, the lessons. And they, because they don't want to, they don't care for workers. They see these workers as expendable. So as of now, on December of 2020, the company is still refusing to tell the workers who were exposed to COVID cases. They are still not putting workers in quarantine. They are still not tracing workers. And they are not providing testing to workers.
Wow.
So it's still like Tyson with this new announcement of vaccinating workers. The vaccines are just a part of that, but it's not everything, you know?
Right.
And it's in here in communities where a lot of people are rejecting the vaccines, we don't have any immunization in the community. You know, I think only 30% of the population in Arkansas are vaccinated. So workers, even though they are vaccinated, they are still exposed to virus. There are still new variants, you know.
Yes, and they can still spread it. And I'm just going to remind my listeners here, because last year I followed, I don't know if you're familiar with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, otherwise known as FERN, and it was a wonderful reporter, Leah Douglas, who's now with Reuters. She was the person who kept track of all the numbers. In fact, she testified in front of Congress, as I recall, or at least she provided that House committee that you stood in front of as well, with some of the numbers that she had gleaned with great difficulty. And one of the things that was clear from her research was that it wasn't just workers in the plants who were getting sick. The community spread was that much exponentially more in communities where there were meatpacking plants just because of this. So it wasn't just the workers. It was their families. It was the grocery store people. It was the kids in school. Everything had this ripple out effect from the fact that they were not providing the basics for the workers in the poultry plants or whatever plant it is. So anyway, sorry, we digress there. But what else could they? Okay, so now Tyson says they've vaccinated 90% of their workforce or whatever. What else do you think needs to be done? You're saying that they need more tracing, contact, more testing. I think everybody should have at-home tests myself. That's what I think would solve this to some degree. But what else should happen?
Yeah, well,
vis-a-vis the plant.
Yeah, but one of the major things that the company should be doing is to remove the fault point system that punishes workers for coming in sick, for missing work, for being sick. So a lot of workers before the pandemic were used to come to work while sick to avoid getting these points.
Right.
The situation right now, it's getting worse. You know, workers are not having enough breaks. Workers are less workers processing the same or more, you know, and working faster. They don't have paid leave. So those benefits, like paid leave, is so essential. And I want to take a parenthesis because Tyson has also announced in this PR campaign that they are going to provide paid leave to workers. So when you read the headlines, it just sounds so amazing as the right to work status will sound. But really what it is that Tyson Foods going to provide paid leave to workers who are vaccinated starting next year and only providing 20 hours of recruit paid leave. So 20 hours per year is a joke, you know, like it's just only 2 days of work, of missing work. So that is not what workers deserve. Workers deserve adequate paid leave. They deserve to be stay at home, to not be afraid of losing their jobs because they were sick and they had to miss work. So these things were essential, you know, and the decision of workers, while many workers kept on coming sick, is because they didn't have any other option. And so the companies still have in place the systems that keep perpetuating this sickness, cycles of sickness. And so, the company should be doing more than mandating vaccines.
Right. I mean, that's a huge thing right there. Basic sick leave. basic. I mean, every other industry provides their workers with basic sick leave. I mean, you get at least 5 or 6 days a year, which again, not a lot, but still, I mean, two is just a joke. So let's move on for a second here, because I wanted to talk, you know, I just mentioned Fern and the Leah Douglas's testimony for in front of the Congressional Subcommittee. And you also testified in front of that subcommittee on October 27th of this year. And they focused on how the Congressional Committee focused on how the meatpacking industry responded to COVID. Did you feel like you were actually speaking to a receptive audience in Congress? I mean, were these people actually listening to what you were saying? Because the abuse of workers in meatpacking isn't just COVID related. It is a decades long issue. Were people sort of informed about what it's like to work in meatpacking already, and you were just amplifying that? Or was all of this brand new? Were they receptive? How did they respond?
Yeah, it was a very unique and awkward moment, to be honest, because the Republicans were not receptive at all. I mean, I think the Democrats, they did a good job since April of this year to investigate what really happened to the meat workers, meatpacking workers in America. We were actually in contact with them, providing interviews with workers. So they were interviewing workers here in Arkansas. We were providing real facts and evidence about how the company purposely exposed workers to get sick and die. And so they did a good job of collecting all this data, you know, to understand that and to this hearing to really help these companies accountable, because as I mentioned before, there is no regulations on this meat in this industry, and it's needed to in order to overcome this pandemic, this company needs to be held accountable for what they did in 2020 to avoid that they continue doing that this in the next years, you know.
Yep.
In 2021. And so in the hearing, the Republicans were just off the topic. You know, they just completely refused to listen. They were very strong witnesses in that hearing, saying firsthand about how they experienced the pandemic in the meatpacking plants or the poultry plants. And so it was shocking that these people were just trying to avoid the issue by just saying that they shouldn't be focusing on the meatpacking industry. They should be focusing on where the virus came from and that they should be investigating China. And it was shocking because really, if you recall, during the Trump administration, they spent the first months of the pandemic denying that there was such a pandemic, there was such a virus, you know?
Right, absolutely.
It was their turn, really, to investigate what was happening then, but they just spent those months saying that they didn't exist. So now they are just avoiding the real issues. The stories of people who had been dying, who had been exposed, who had been suffering for the lack of leadership during that administration, and now they are turning into the issue as if we were beginning the pandemic. I mean, that is just. I mean, I'm not saying it's not important, but really, where are we as a country, you know, as a country that just want to avoid their issues and to not seeing the true issues to change that? Or where are we, you know? And that was really concerning to me.
Oh, I think, I mean, it should be concerning to every man, woman, and child in this country. I mean, eventually it's going to come back and bite all of us in the rear end. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you can't just eliminate workers' rights and pretend that the only people who matter are the 1%. And that's the Republican playbook right
and
now.
It's
so
really not to avoid the fact that that workers' health is public health, you know, and especially
with
the pandemic, if these workers get sick, it's going to go back to the communities where they are. And it's just going to go back. They are seen as a racist point of view. You know, we are brown, the most affected, but really we are all human beings. And yes, we can also, the white people can also get sick. So it's just, as that, you know, as that if they didn't have a triple effect.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is, you know, I think everybody who pays any attention to this sees that the largest caseloads, the largest numbers of fatalities are now among white communities that refuse to get vaccinated and don't wear masks. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's Darwinian. There you go. We should talk for a second. Let's take a really short break. And then we'll come right back. I do want to talk about immigration for a couple of minutes. I know it's not your primary focus, but we can't really talk about the meatpacking industry without talking about immigration reform. So bear with me while I try to get a few details from you. But we'll be right back after the sponsor break. Stay tuned, people.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Okay. So anyway, the largest demographic that work in meat processing of any type are immigrant communities and primarily undocumented workers. Can you talk a little bit about the ways that the lack of documentation and the lack of a coherent immigration policy, whatever that might turn out to be, has aided and abetted the exploitation of these workers?
Yes. Well, I want to expand the topic, but like to
talk go ahead. About,
well, first of all, like immigration in Arkansas happened because of the poultry industry, you know?
Yes.
Many people from Mexico. Actually, Tyson was smuggling illegally Mexicans to work in the processing plants, but also a lot of people, Latinx community, immigrated from California to work in the processing plants because the processing plants were providing incentives to workers to bring their families, their friends, whoever they wanted to work in these industries. Now, there is also a lot of population. There is a huge population from Marshallese, from the Marshall Island, coming to work at these processing plants in Springdale. You know, the majority of the workers now in those big plants are also documented workers. You know, I've seen that the smaller the plant is, the more easily for undocumented people to work. But I see more undocumented people working also in the farms, growing the chickens, you know? But also, the issue of exploitation doesn't only happen because workers are undocumented, you know?
Okay.
I think that the exploitation goes to all the workers who are vulnerable to not knowing the language, not knowing the culture, because we are also located in wide rural areas where there is a lot of anti-immigrant laws, you know, that make the communities feel powerless. And also the issue of, of not knowing their own rights in another country.
Right.
And
just
because we are in rural communities, there is not like a lot of opportunities to find other jobs, you know? So they get locked out into these jobs and they don't have more resources. So there's a lot of things, you know, that are involved in how these companies operate to keep exploiting workers. And yes, there is a huge population of undocumented people working in processing plants, because at the end of the day, these companies are eager to vulnerable workers. They need vulnerable workers to exploit.
Sure. So
right now, for example, we are seeing a huge population of refugees coming into Arkansas. And it's not really for because Arkansas is so diverse. they care for the immigrants' rights.
And right, right.
When I saw that, it was, for me, it was a red flag and knowing that these people are coming to work in the processing plants. And yes, that is has been the truth. Most of the refugees coming to Arkansas are placed in working in processing plants. So now we are going to be seeing probably more people coming with legal status to work. You know, like there was during the Trump administration, there was this effort of expanding H-2A visas to processing workers, you know, because at the end of the day, they have learned that it's just a matter of the circumstances that they will keep exploiting workers despite of their immigration status. Right now, really, all the workers, essential workers, deserve a path of citizenship, you know?
Sure.
I think other countries have led into those efforts to allow undocumented people during the pandemic to become citizens. And I think right now that should be the question. Like, why are the essential workers still struggling to have a path of citizenship, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question.
Yeah.
I mean, my personal view is that immigration, which I thought was going to happen when George W. Bush came into office, he talked a great game about immigration, right? And making immigration reform a priority, and his administration was going to solve these problems, blah, blah, blah. And in the end, it was, I think, primarily the food industry that just shut that right down. Because for them, as you've just made the case, for them, having undocumented or documented but vulnerable employees means that they can fire at will.
Yeah.
Discourage unionization, deny them basic labor rights. I mean, you know, it's just so easy when you have a population that doesn't speak the language very well, doesn't read the language well, you know, and doesn't have, as you said, community support. I mean, I one thing I wanted to ask you about is you've mentioned a couple times anti-immigration laws that are on the books in Arkansas. Can you give us an example of one of those?
Well, I mean, the fact that workers are not allowed to even get a driver license, you know.
Oh, right.
They're still struggling to get, I mean, a driver license, an ID, you know.
Yeah.
That their identity has been erased by the laws is just pretty much what we faced in Arkansas, you know.
Incredible.
That also we have this program 287G in place that workers that don't have a driver license, if they get pulled up by the police, they will end up in jail in a process of deportation, you know.
Right. Right.
So this 287G policies that exist in a lot of towns in the South and a lot of cities and white rural communities or cities in the South exist, it is precisely to criminalize immigrants, you know.
Wow.
And to deport them. So yeah.
Yes. Right. Incredible. So let's talk about some of the ways that your Venceremos organizing tactics can result in change. Like, let's first of all identify what that change would look like. What are your goals as far as workers go? Because we're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon. But it's like transparency in wages, because I know that people don't know what everybody else is getting paid, you know, in different plants or even inside of a plant. And I know that, for example, poultry, people who raise poultry, the growers have no idea what the guy next, you know, in the farm next door is getting for his birds. So that's, you know, transparency, access to adequate health care. That would be another thing, right? Paid sick leave, as we just discussed, mandated breaks and bathroom breaks. People don't realize that when you're working on the chain, on the line, on the processing line, if somebody steps out to take a bathroom break, either someone has to come right in and take their place or the chain has to slow down. Nobody likes that. So there's no bathroom breaks. People wear diapers, right? So there's got to be some way of changing that. And what about, and no retaliation for speaking out and organizing. Are there other things that you would like to see become sort of the norm rather than the exception in terms of poultry workers?
Yeah, two things. One is the regulation of chemicals at the plant, and regulation of the line speed that needs to be regulated and decreased, actually.
Oh, so
those are the big, some of the biggest asks for the workers that are still struggling. Right now, with the shortage of labor, less workers are processing the same or more and faster. Right. So there is more accidents more untrained people doing untrained jobs. So there is more exposure to injuries. There is a lot of things to regulate. And that's why Venceremos right now, as I told you, we are a grassroots worker-led organization that has been very successful because we are giving workers a voice. You know, and workers are part of building this work, whereas other organization here is always top down, and we always know that the changes must come from the workers. So by uplifting the voices of workers, exposing the stories, we are creating more leadership with the workers, creating this power among workers, you know, that is very needed in these communities. So we, in the long term, as I said, we plan to adopt the worker-driven social responsibility, because if there is no regulation of any policy that company says, if there is no driven by workers, if workers don't have a way to monitor any implementation of anything, the workers won't be happening because workers are not part of that. So, we hope that in the future that can be a truth for poultry workers.
Yeah, unbelievable. So what should consumers learn? You know, what do consumers need to know about the poultry industry? Like, what would help people understand what is going on in this industry, really across the board in meatpacking, but poultry workers especially? I mean, that you mentioned line speed, for example, you know, process. And that was another thing that they exploited during the pandemic, was raising a lot of plants, got a dispensation to raise their line speed from, I think, 141 birds a minute. Think about that, people. 141 birds a minute. They wanted to raise it to 175. And I know for a fact that in the past, they have asked for 190. So, I mean, this is just insane, crazy stuff.
They increased the line speed. They gave some waivers to increase the line speed to 174 birds per minute to some companies. But also I want to note that because there is no regulation, and during the Trump administration, the inspectors of USDA inspectors have decreased, there is no way the companies will violate the current line speed, you know, because there is, if nobody is there to check and they need to process more and keep up the production quota, it will be a violation of that. So workers in all the plants have seen an increase of the line speed, even though these companies didn't get a waiver. But because there is not inspectors to regulate anything, the company will violate that.
So
they also, I think the important part of the consumers to really understand is everything has an effect, you know. How workers are treated obviously will affect the quality of the meat that we consume, you know.
Thank you.
So all the workers are talking about that the companies don't care for quality anymore. And so that also affects that, but also the responsibility of and the power of the consumers to change those things for workers, you know. At the end of the day, the power of purchase, we have the power of saying, you know, we are consuming your product, therefore I want you to treat the workers with respect. And they need to support organizations who are leading those efforts with Venceremos, you know.
Right.
To support our work, because at the end of the day, it will also benefit them, you know. It's just like they have a responsibility, they have a power to also help uplift the workers' voices.
Absolutely. So how do people learn more about Venceremos and the fight to bring better working conditions and wages to meatpacking workers and poultry workers around the country?
Yeah, we're in all social media. We're in Facebook with Venceremos Arkansas, and also in Twitter, venceremos.ar, and also in Instagram, venceremos.arkansas. And we are now creating our website. So whenever we are ready, probably early next year, we are in the process of that. We are going to be sharing that as well.
That's fantastic. Magali, thank you so, so much for joining me today. And I hope you'll come back. I mean, I want to stay in touch. I love these interviews. I think you're a terrific spokesperson for your cause. And you understand so deeply and thoroughly the issues that these people are facing. And really, everyone deserves to know this. Like you said, it's the power of purchase. It's the dollar value. It's like if we stop buying from these companies, then they have to make some changes. And you know, and that's what it's all about, folks. So thank you very much, my dear, for joining me again for another time. I really appreciate your time. And thanks to my sponsors. And I have one more thing to say, which has nothing to do with this interview, but does have to do with other great podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, I think you will also like Ask a Harvard Professor. There, you will hear from some of the world's most prominent scholars. One episode you might like features Emily Broad-Leib, a clinical professor of law at Harvard Law School, on finding simple solutions to reduce food waste. Very important topic, people. So subscribe to Ask a Harvard Professor on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And please do check her out. And Emily's going to be on my show in a few weeks after the Christmas break. I think she's coming on sometime in January. And we'll talk more about food waste then. But in the meantime, Magali, thank you again for all of your time. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing and value your contribution to all of our knowledge base here about these really important questions. So we'll see, folks. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time. Have a great week. And that's it for today's episode. So long for now.
What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, there. I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat & 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.